We have another leader here on transportation, and that's our own Congressman John Mica. I've known the congressman for many years when I served on Capitol Hill. He had the adjoining district to the one that my boss represented. But he's in his eighth term as Florida's 7th district congressional district, which stretches from this area up to northeast Florida. Representative Mica is a former member, as the leader said, of the Florida House, and also served as chief of staff in the United States Senate. In the U.S. House, Congressman Mica has served as the chairman of the Civil Service, Criminal Justice, and Drug Policy and Aviation Subcommittees. As a national leader in transportation and former chairman of the Aviation Subcommittee, Representative Mica is one of the principal authors of our nation's transportation security legislation following the attacks of September 11th. He is credited with bringing America's devastated aviation industry back from the brink of disaster. In 2007, Congressman Mica was elected by his peers in the House to serve as the Republican leader on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, the largest committee in Congress. Mr. Mica serves on all 6 subcommittees: Aviation, Highways and Transit, Railroads, Coast Guard, Water Resources, and Economic Development and Emergency Management. As the ranking member on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, Representative Mica has been a leader in improving our nation's water infrastructure, increasing and more efficiently utilizing our nation's airways, bettering government's emergency response capabilities, and ensuring the solvency of the Highway Trust Fund. The Congressman has called for a national strategic transportation plan for our country and has supported a reinvigorated commitment to improving America's infrastructure. His efforts and vision in the field of transportation have gained him recognition by numerous organizations and national associations. It is with great honor that I introduce to you Congressman John Mica.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the introduction, Madam Secretary. And first of all, I want to welcome all of you to Central Florida. This is not my district. This is south end of my district. Actually, I start up at Winter Park and go all the way to Jacksonville, thanks to gerrymandering. But that's a long subject. We'll discuss that at another time. But I'm delighted to be here, and I've had such a great working relationship with our secretary. She headed up actually federal transportation affairs in Washington, where we struggled to try to come up with the last transportation bill. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but she is doing an incredible job in trying to lead Florida. I'm pleased to also be here with the chair of our commission. He tries to keep transportation on track in the state of Florida, does a great job. It's wonderful that we have citizen leaders and participation in the process that's so important. But I'm really privileged to be here with Dan Webster. You know, you hear all these things today about public servants and some of them getting off the track or in trouble, but I'll tell you what, we have been so fortunate in Florida to have the leadership of Dan Webster. I actually tried to get him to run for Congress in 1992. I was out actually recruiting, trying to help my party get someone with redistricting. Florida gets 2 new seats every 10 years, whether we want them or not, with everybody moving into the state. But I went over and sat in his office, and he's a great person to have in public office. Not only a family man, a man of great personal faith, but also someone who knows the bottom line in business. But I sat in his office and I talked to him, and he wasn't ready at the time to run, so he let me run. But that's history, and he became the president of our Senate. So we're so proud of him. The thing that I regret is that this is the end of his term, but I know it's not the end of his public service, and I know he'll he'll continue to serve the state and the nation the way he has in the past. But I'm delighted to be on the same stage with him today. And Stephanie and Marcus, thank you for your service. I'm here actually, folks, on a work release program. It was either come here and speak to this full crowd or go up and get in line to speak to an empty house chamber. Although we are bringing in the tourists to listen. As you know, the conclusion of our session was rather inglorious. The speaker gaveled it to a close and turned the lights out and C-SPAN off, which usually, once the cameras go, usually everybody leaves in elected office, but we're staying nonstop, and I think it's an important mission right now. The whole country's hurting because of the energy crisis we face. Our lack of independence is, as far as energy, is causing great pain, not only at the pump and at the grocery store, but for hundreds of millions of Americans, and many of them on limited income, and really, really hurting. It's hurting the economy. Not only is it hurting the economy, as you know, it's hurting the Highway Trust Fund. People do react when they can't fill up the tank and drive. They cut down on their driving, and as you know, our federal gas tax is based on about 18.4 cents per gallon. When people stop driving, the money stops coming into the trust fund, whether it's the state or the federal fund, and you see the revenues go down. So not only is there a crisis across the country and on a personal basis and painful basis for our citizens, but every state is seeing a decrease in the federal trust fund, is seeing a decrease in our net revenues. So we have a crisis. We got some news about a week or so ago, just before we left. It may not be as bad because some of the projects, I guess, are being put on hold, and we'll hear more from if the administration representative gets here about the exact figures that they're seeing. But we're looking at basically a $4 to $6 billion shortfall in the Highway Trust Fund, as some of you have heard. Mr. Oberstar, who is my Democrat counterpart and chairs the Transportation and Infrastructure, he and I, along with Charlie Rangel and Jim McCreary, his Republican counterpart, we saw the need. We passed actually a larger amount than we need to keep the trust fund current, about $8 billion. Some of you were wondering, what's going to happen. First of all, we did that because we're hearing from many of you that you not being able to get federal commitments and the federal government, if they don't have the money in their treasury, so to speak, or the trust fund, is not going to let you obligate the money, nor are they going to provide you with the money. The last thing we want is a cutback, especially when the economy is down. So we did act. The House did pass $8 billion. The final total will probably be less than that. My guess is it probably will not be our standalone bill that will pass. We do have to act somewhat responsibly at the federal level, where I say somewhat responsibly. We're not like the state level where you have to balance your budget and be totally responsible. The difference here, folks, let me tell you the difference is we print the money. So those presses are going 24/7. Every time I leave, I go by where they're printing the dollar bills, and I can hear it whether I leave late at night or early in the morning. Those presses are whining, and they're pumping out the money. But that's not the long-term solution, as you well know. I shouldn't predict, you know. People ask me who's going to be the Republican Democrat nominee, and I said Hillary Clinton, and who was the other one? Giving up my political prognostication, I will take a stab and tell you that I feel pretty good about Congress in September passing, probably in the continuing resolution, some restoration of the funds that we need to keep going, in the trust fund. It'll probably be somewhere between $4 and $6 billion, based again on the most accurate estimates that we have. But we have to keep you going, we have to keep the economy going, and we have to keep transportation projects moving forward. Now, that is only, again, a temporary Band-Aid. We're going to have to borrow that money from general revenue to put into the trust fund. You all know we're facing a bigger crisis, and that crisis continues every month as we see less coming into the trust fund. We have less because people are driving less. We have two other factors, as you know, that are contributing. One, every day the fleet on the road becomes more efficient. I drove last night with a friend. We went to dinner together, and he had a hybrid. Didn't even hear the whine of a gasoline or a diesel engine that starts out to electric. And every day there are more cars on the road that are using some alternative fuel, whether it's ethanol, electricity, or whatever we have. So eventually, even if we increase the gas tax, you know, there was a proposal, some said, from the Federal Commission that we go out and do it 40 cents. If we did it for increase the gas tax $4 at the federal level, and no one's using gasoline as we know it or traditional fuels, it wouldn't matter. It doesn't resolve the problem that we've got. The problem we've got in addressing the next transportation bill at the federal level is we're going to have to find a transition to get us to another stage. It may take 2 5-year bills to get us to where we have a whole new way of collecting revenue, but we do need to transition into that account for alternative fuels and for cars going further on one gallon of gasoline. So that needs to be fixed. It must be fixed. And as you know, our deadline is next September 30th to replace the current bill. Let me make one pledge to you here today. This is assuming I'm not defeated in the November election, but right now the odds are pretty good. Both of my alleged opponents are in debt. That's the way the other side usually runs the campaign and the government. But we won't get into that here. But assuming that I'm around, Mr. Oberstar and Mr. Oberstar is around, we are going to do everything we can in our power to make certain that we don't leave you in the lurch next September 30th. I've seen this done. I've been in Congress for 16 years. I've seen it done almost every year since about 1991. That it takes Congress anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years to figure out what the next highway and transportation bill is going to be. We're going to do everything we can to try to bring in a bill as soon as possible. Thank you. Go ahead. We haven't done it yet, but we, so don't get too excited, Ben. But let me tell you, I can't do it without you. Mr. Oberstar and I can't do it. We're the leaders of the committee. We've got the largest committee in Congress. It's not manageable, neither is the Congress, but with your help, I think we can do this. And we've committed already. We're going to start after the election, where we've done some preliminary hearings. But we want to hit the ground running, and we need you as part of that. And that's one reason I'm pleased to be with so many leaders in transportation this morning and ask for your help. Now, you heard Stephanie talk a little bit about my proposals for the bill. Folks, now, I want you to know that while you were partying last night and having a good time, and we do have some of that on tape, I was not out. I told you I went to dinner last night. I was not smoking dope. I preface what my remarks because I'm going to tell you that I'd like to do a mega bill next year. And I base this bill on not something a pie in the sky number that I've picked out, but a number that the American Society of Civil Engineers has told us that this country needs as an investment for 5 years in its infrastructure. And that's a $1.5 trillion gross amount of infrastructure funding. Now, you put that in perspective, the last TILU bill that we did was $284 billion for 5 years. So that's why I told you I am not smoking dope. But I think we can do that. I think that's the need that this country has to build its infrastructure. And this country can't compete, expand jobs and opportunities, compete in a global market if we don't have the infrastructure. And that, if you look at the history of economic development throughout the world, whether it's coming down the Nile, whether it was traversing the Atlantic and the seas, or spanning the country with rail, all economic development in this country and in the world has evolved around transportation initiatives and development. And we are now competing against what I call China Inc. and UK Inc. and others who have sort of a seamless combination of government, private sector, and other activities all rolled into one that we're competing against. So we need to do a better job in building our infrastructure. Now, let me tell you the MICA plan, so to speak, that you may have heard of, which is I have called for a national strategic transportation infrastructure plan and policy. First thing we need is a policy. What is going to be the role of the federal government in being involved? And you heard Dan Webster talk about partnerships. But we have to define the partnerships. What's the federal government role? Not since Eisenhower proposed in 1954, when the federal budget was $78 billion, a half a trillion dollar interstate system, have we even proposed any type of national strategic transportation plan. And that was just for one mode, for highways. But we need to do that, define what the state's role is, the federal government's role is, the private sector's role is. And once we set that definition, I'm very confident that you, working at the state level, but knowing the rules of the game, what you're responsible for, what we're responsible for, we can do a better job. We also need to look at investment of other monies, not just United States cash, but international. There's a huge amount of international money, as you know, and you've seen with some of these recent financing schemes. Talking about financing, the second part, in addition to having a federal policy defined as to what our roles and responsibilities are, the second most important thing, and really probably the most important thing, is cash, and that's financing these projects. You know, if you have the money to finance the project, you can build the project, you can do the project. And right now, we don't have that. We have a declining system. So we've got to, declining revenue in system, and we've got to replace that with something that brings in more net revenue. Then the other thing we've got to do is take that revenue and spend it wiser. And we've got to rely on creative financing, we've got to rely on bonding, we've got to rely on a host of different financing mechanisms, some of which I must admit my administration has been very myopic about in Washington. But I think we need to redefine that. Where it makes sense, we'll have the government also back some of these projects with guarantees or participation. But that is the way we can, I believe, again, get to the $1.5 trillion. First by a net increase in revenues, and that'll bring us to somewhere, I think, and Mr. Oberstar's committed to that, about $500 billion, about $500 million. The second is creative financing, which I think is worth about another $500 billion if properly crafted. The third and final way we can enhance the money that's available is through public-private partnerships. If we just define what the public-private partnership relationship is, we will bring in an incredible amount of investment. Public-private partnerships around the world that we've seen and some that have been proposed provide an excellent alternative, but we have to define the manner in which we participate and who can participate and at what level. So that's sort of the master plan elements. The first one is policy, the second is finance, and the third element I propose is improving the process. The technical people that are here, the others that are here, everybody knows that when the federal government gets involved in a project, and we had one of the commissioners who was part of the federal study group come and testify to us in Congress, and he said anytime the federal government gets involved in a project, it usually takes 2 to 3 times as long and it costs 3 to 4 times as much. I got I worked with Senator Hawkins as the chief of staff back in the 1980s and worked on an interchange up in the northern part of Seminole County. I think it was 16 years later, and probably Dan helped finish it, and I was at the federal level, that we finally built the interchange. That's absolutely absurd. Now, I have in process what I call my 437-day processing plan. The 437 days is the number of days that it will take to replace the bridge over I-35 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's how they condense that time frame for permitting and approval, 437 days for replacement. There is no reason why most projects, replacements and others that aren't changing the footprint or nature of a transportation project cannot move forward in an expedited basis. So my goal is 437 days max for processing for most routine projects. My staff tells me that it would take 7 to 8 years to if you went through the normal process to approve that bridge. So that's part of the plan, again, policy, finance, and process. And I'm hoping that with your help, we can achieve that. I'm not going to talk much about the administration proposal other than to say it's sort of a good start. It encompasses some of the things that I've talked about. I think it's a smaller glimpse take on the bigger picture. You'll hear from Tyler Duvall with the administration if his plane makes it. That's another issue, but we won't get into aviation congestion at this conference, just highway and transportation problems that you see every day. Finally, I want to say that as Congress concludes its work before the election, it's also my hope that if we do an additional economic stimulation package, that we can include a proposal. Mr. Oberstar has proposed a $15 billion plan. I don't know, I'm not going to commit to any numbers. They're most of what he's proposed I agree with. AASHTO has identified billions of dollars worth of projects that are within 90 days ready to go. I think whatever we do propose, if we can do something in September to help stimulate the economy and move projects forward, I'll be behind that and support that, because we can't let the economy flounder. We can't let these projects flounder at this important and critical time. Finally, and in conclusion, as we begin this process in 2009 and we lead up to, again, a new highway and transportation bill, this battle is going to require the enlistment of everybody in this room. What I'd like to do is call on you, whether you're leaders or whether you're technical people, to be part of this process. And I'll tell you, the best ideas I have ever gotten any of my work at any level of government is from people who, like yourselves, that are experts who day in, day out are doing a good job. But I would really welcome your suggestions. You can send them to me anonymously, whatever. You can contact us, but I welcome you as we go through that process, because I think with your input, you are, the most knowledgeable people about the process and about what needs to be done. We can do an even better job. So I conclude with asking you and requesting and pleading with you to be part of making our transportation legislation and our bill for the next 5 years a success, and it can only be that by having you being a full partner in that process. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you and bring you my little perspective from Washington. Thank you.